This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Arlington, Virginia, just across the Potomac River from here, is about to change in a big way. It will become home to one of Amazon's two new headquarters. The other will be in Long Island City, a neighborhood in Queens, New York. The tech giant has promised 50,000 new jobs and an investment of more than $5 billion across those two cities. Amazon has changed retail forever, for better or worse, and drawn a lot of criticism in the process. The critics often point to the laws on antitrust as proof that our nation is better off when big companies cannot get too big. But how big is too big? I mean, what does that even mean? Capitalism and free enterprise are hallmarks of our nation. You can build a company and make it grow and maybe make a fortune. How do we know if a company grows too powerful? What laws are in place to contain one that does? Or are some of these concerns overblown and consumers are better off when big companies can save us money? Joining us from NPR in New York is Lina Khan, a senior fellow at the Open Markets Institute and an associate research scholar at the Yale Law School. As a law student, she wrote Amazon's Antitrust Paradox, an article that changed the conversation around antitrust law. Lina, welcome to 1A.
Good to be here.
Also with us from New York is Tim Wu, a law professor at Columbia and the author of The Curse of Bigness, Antitrust in the New Gilded Age. He also coined the phrase net neutrality, referring to the principle that all web content should flow from every site to every user without advantage or impediment. Professor Wu, thanks for joining us.
A pleasure to be here.
We also welcome your questions and thoughts, particularly if Amazon's HQ2 or HQ2 plus 1 are going to be affecting you, or if you just have questions about the way we deal with big businesses. Email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Professor Wu, let me start with you and this idea of antitrust. What exactly do we mean in this context by a trust, and why are there laws that are anti these trusts?
That's a good point. So a trust is a 19th century word for monopoly, and the antitrust laws were a reaction to the first Gilded Age, the period where almost every American industry was controlled by a single monopolist. Standard Oil is the most famous. You had U.S. Steel. You had a trust for films. You had a trust for cigarettes, a trust for just about everything. And I guess one of my points is that we're heading back in that direction, it feels like, where you have either oligopolies or monopolies in almost every industry. The antitrust law was invented in America to break monopoly, and that one of the things I think is we're needing to reinvigorate it.
This may be a facile question, Professor, but what's wrong with monopolies and oligopolies? What's the risk?
It's a good question. It's a deep question. So one is the sort of more straightforward idea that they tend to raise prices. They themselves tend to stagnate after a while. Monopoly can be like a narcotic that makes the industry just sit there and not feel it needs to do anything. But I think it's a little more fundamental. It's about power. Monopolies potentially can become as powerful as elected government. They're unaccountable. There's no elections. And when you think about people's real lives, how you live day to day, often your experience is more shaped by your dealings with private firms. And if you have no real power, and I'll add employees to this too, if you are such a small unit compared to such a big employer, it really starts to affect the kind of freedoms we enjoy in this country and what it means to live. So those are some of the reasons I think they're sort of antithetical to the democratic project.
I want to get into some of Lina Khan's argument about trusts and monopolies and Amazon in just a moment. But, Professor, a little more clarification, if we could. In terms of what a monopoly is, how do we know under the law whether something is or is not a monopoly? Is there a clear standard?
It's been debated for a very long time. The way the law defines it is essentially the ability to act with impunity, to raise prices or exclude their competitors. So think about Microsoft in the 90s. They had this troublesome little company named Netscape, and they basically managed to push them out of business entirely. So it is fundamentally a measure of unaccountable power that's what it comes down to, what Monopoly is.
I'm sure some people in our audience just went like, oh yeah, Netscape, I remember them. Remember Netscape Navigator all those years ago? Explain what antitrust laws, Professor, are designed to do. If you know, Joshua Johnson Incorporated is deemed to violate the antitrust laws, what is it that you can force me to do as a result of those laws?
Well, one thing we could do if you're a monopolist is the traditional remedies to break you into smaller pieces, to reintroduce competition. You know, Standard Oil was broken into something like 36 different companies. The other is that you tell the company to stop. So, you know, and compete fairly. There's such a thing as fair competition, you know, better products, lower prices. And there's another thing called unfair competition, which is, for example, Microsoft made everybody agree not to carry Netscape, and so Netscape couldn't get anywhere. And so they were killed. So it basically is either about breakups or mandating a fairer competition.
And how do you know what kind of break to make, what kind of break to order? Like, say it was Joshua Johnson Incorporated, I own TV stations and newspapers and radio stations and websites, and I own, you know, digital devices, I own all this stuff, and you say, ah, too big, sorry, you need to get smaller. How do you know where to cut?
That is the art of the remedy. It's not an easy question. Let's take a company like Facebook, which I've called for the breakup of. The easiest thing to do is just dissolve the constituent parts. So Facebook, in my view, illegally acquired Instagram and WhatsApp, two of its main competitors.
Illegally, and because it made it too big and made it too monopolistic?
No. Well, that's one way of putting it. Also, it you know, the legal standard is it reduced competition. It bought off its competitors to avoid competition. You know, Instagram was poised, I think, in the 2010s, same with WhatsApp, to become challengers to Facebook, and instead they were bought off and eliminated, and that's illegal under the Clayton Act. So you would just dissolve the company into three pieces. More complicated remedies are ones where you kind of chop the company up vertically. You know, some people have sometimes said maybe we should let YouTube be free or something. Or Google Shopping. So there are different ways of doing it, and it's not. It's more of an art than a science, I'd say.
All right. Well, Professor Wu, I appreciate you walking us through all of this for the beginning. Lena Khan, I also appreciate your patience on this because I know that you have strong perspectives about whether Amazon meets the standards under antitrust law, right?
That's right. I mean, when thinking about Amazon, you have to be a bit more precise because Amazon's involved in so many different lines of business, right? It's a major online platform, but it's also involved in logistics and delivery. It has a huge media production arm. It won an Oscar the other year. It's a huge cloud computing provider. So I think Amazon at this stage is involved in so many different lines of business that it's difficult to make sense of what exactly it is.
So does it meet the standard under the law currently for antitrust?
Well, the way the law approaches that question is that it identifies a specific market and then assesses, okay, what is this company's role in this market? In some markets, Amazon has upwards of 70-80% of that market, especially in some lines of the book market. As a general online retailer, Amazon has close to 50% of the market. Again, you have to really look at this case by case, but generally speaking, once you are past the 50% mark, that can start raising significant antitrust scrutiny. But a lot of it depends on how you're using that power in the particular market.
We're speaking to Lena Khan, a senior fellow at the Open Markets Institute and an associate research scholar at Yale Law School, and Columbia Law professor Tim Wu, the author of The Curse of Bigness, Antitrust in the New Gilded Age. Glad to get some of your questions and thoughts about antitrust and Amazon and so forth. Alyssa in Illinois left this message in our inbox.
I do not believe that they need any intervention from the government or publicly. I do believe that they're regulating themselves fairly well for how large they are. I think the only time that we need to intervene in their dealings is if they are doing something that is either illegal or something that is not benefiting the employees that work there or the consumers that buy their products.
Alyssa, thanks for sharing your thoughts with us. Lena, what would you say to Alyssa?
Well, I think there's an argument to be made that Amazon's actually already engaged in business practices that 30, 40 years ago would have been considered illegal under the antitrust laws. There's an aspect of the law that prohibits what's known as predatory pricing. So predatory pricing is when you price goods below cost in order to drive out your rivals. And then once you get rid of them, you're able to then you have the market power to raise prices. There have been several instances where Amazon has engaged in aggressive price wars. A few years ago, there was a company called Diapers.com that was very popular. It was gaining a lot of traction. Amazon decided to go head-to-head with it, designed an algorithm to actually price its diapers always a little bit below what Diapers.com was pricing, ended up squeezing the company, buying it, and then after it bought it up, it raised its diapers prices with one less competitor in the marketplace. So that's the kind of conduct that antitrust laws were supposed to prohibit. They were really supposed to prohibit the abuse of size in the marketplace. And I think at some point, oftentimes, when a company achieves a certain level of power, a certain level of size in a marketplace, abuse of that power can become more and more common. And I think that's potentially what we're starting to see with Amazon.
Professor Wu, anything you would add to that?
Yeah, I think if we took the author's view of the author email's view, we would have a very different economic landscape. The author's view wouldn't have broken up AT&T, for instance, which I think was responsible for the jump-starting of the American telecom industry. It wouldn't have gone after Microsoft, so all of the web would probably be ruled by Microsoft at this point. So I think an enormous amount of economic growth is attributable in part to the courageous enforcement of the antitrust laws. And I think if we'd taken the author's approach, we would be in a much different economy.
We'll continue our conversation in a moment with Lina Khan and Professor Tim Wu and get to some more of your questions as well. Lady Bren asks, if it wasn't for the rise of Walmart, would there be Amazon? Good question. We'll see if we can get you an answer in just a moment. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're discussing Amazon, other big tech companies, and the antitrust laws we have to protect consumers, and whether those laws are prepared to do that work in our current digital world. With Lina Khan, senior fellow at the Open Markets Institute, associate research scholar at Yale Law, and fellow at the Information Society Project. And Tim Wu, a law professor at Columbia University and author of The Curse of Bigness, Antitrust in the New Gilded Age, and also the person who coined the phrase net neutrality, and I beg your pardon, a fellow at Columbia Law School. Lena is a fellow at Columbia Law School. Sorry about that. We'd love to get your questions and thoughts about antitrust, Amazon, HQ2, or HQ2 plus one, especially if you live in Long Island City in Queens, or if you're here in the D.C. metro area, or if you are in Nashville, where Amazon is going to open a new operations center. How do you feel about these big companies coming to your town? Maybe you are in a part of Texas where new tech companies have put down more roots. Maybe you are in Nevada where Tesla opened its new battery factory. How does it affect you and your community, your neighbors, your neighborhood when a big company comes to town promising jobs and economic growth in exchange for help from your local government? We welcome your questions and stories. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A or email 1A@wamu.org. Lena, I wonder if you'd respond to Lady Bren's question, who asked, if it wasn't for the rise of Walmart, would there be Amazon? Lena?
That's an interesting question. I think, in many ways, Amazon is building on and refining some of the tactics that Walmart first started employing in the marketplace. But I think in some ways, Amazon is quite different. For one thing, Amazon has expanded into all sorts of lines of business that make it much more than a retailer. In many ways, Amazon is an infrastructure company for 21st century commerce. It has infrastructure in its online marketplace, the kind of platform that it provides for millions of merchants. It also has an enormous physical infrastructure. It has trucks, a logistics network, leases ships and planes, and then it also has online, in the cloud computing system, infrastructure there. So in many ways, Amazon has really moved way beyond being just a retailer. It's actually the infrastructure on which more and more retailers actually have to do their own business.
We heard from Mark in Colorado to give us his thoughts on big tech companies. Here's what he left in our inbox.
I think that Facebook and Google are a special classification of companies that have an extraordinary amount of power over every aspect of our lives in terms of privacy and personal information. So I believe it would be good to have regulations to supervise what they're doing and keep them in check. So hopefully our leadership will affect regulation that will help Facebook and Google to operate in a responsible manner.
Mark, thanks for sharing your thoughts with us. Professor Wu, I wonder if you could chime in terms of tech companies and antitrust. It's kind of complicated. I wonder if it's kind of complicated with companies in a sector like tech, which is so new and where so many people succeed and fail and companies start and they fold. I mean, you know, if go back to the dawn of radio, if there was NBC and CBS and CBS had gone belly up and NBC was the only one left, does that make NBC a monopoly? You know, Google existed, and then there were Excite and Lycos and a bunch of other search engines who I can't even recall. And then they went belly up, and Google's the last one standing. How do we suss that out in terms of whether companies are monopolistic or whether they just succeeded where others failed?
Yes, that's right. So the sort of natural winner. I think that sometimes happens. And, you know, I don't begrudge. Google's a good example. I think they did win their original market power fair and square. But I want to tell you, tech is not new anymore. This is a mature industry. And, you know, things go in cycles. This idea that, oh, you know, the next new guy just shows up and challenges Google, and that's 10 or 20 years ago. I think that's the thinking of the past. You know, this industry is consolidated. It's mature. It's in a totally different situation than it was. And that's why people are starting to talk about, hey, what's going on? Why is this monopoly still here? We need to kind of remove the blinders when it comes to tech. And, you know, the vacation, the honeymoon is over. You know, the caller just said, we're getting, with a company like Facebook, Google, you know, the privacy questions posed by them are becoming very serious, and there's no real sign of competition as something that's going to be a disciplining effect on them. That's why, you know, I think we can just no longer grant this ongoing immunity to the antitrust laws that we've had for the last 20 years.
Levi emailed, my city of Raleigh, North Carolina was on the possible list for one of Amazon's HQ2s. It would have been nice to see such a company have a footprint in the South. I feel like most companies, like Amazon, forget somewhat about the South. This would be a great help for states like ours to build up. Worth noting that Amazon is putting an operation center in Nashville that's supposed to bring, I think, 5,000 jobs when all is said and done. Nowhere near what's coming to New York or the D.C. area, but still some jobs coming to Tennessee. Ron posted on our Facebook page, antitrust is a real and present threat, particularly in healthcare. Where I live, there are two massive hospital groups which dominate completely. Clearly, they therefore control prices just as completely. I think most people have watched this happen for years and have thrown up their hands as the government failed to intercede. Lena, what about that? Do you feel like tech is kind of the heart of where we should be concerned about antitrust, or are there other industries that folks should also be paying more attention to?
There are definitely a lot of industries that suffer from many of the problems that Tim was describing. You know, this is by no means just a tech industry problem. It's dramatic consolidation, and a lack of competition is something that we now see in the airline market, in rental car market, across the healthcare industry, in the mattress industry, in the seed industry, in the chicken industry. For a while, I was trying to find, like, what is the most obscure market where I can find a lack of competition. I think the earthquake insurance market is high on the list. But I think, you know, really, we're now seeing that excessive consolidation and lack of competition now looks to be a systemic feature of our political economy. It's not an isolated issue. And I think that's what, in turn, is helping turn back questions to antitrust enforcement and whether we've been really approaching antitrust the right way for the last few decades, where we've seen these dramatic waves of consolidation.
Can I chime in here for
Sure.
a second? Because I think the caller's point is very, very good one. First of all, I think tech, in some ways, even though it's right in front of our face and we see Amazon, you know, that's important. But the problem is much, much larger than tech. And I want to point out that it also affects something I think a lot of people care about, which is the share of the economy that goes to employees and frankly, the middle class. If you have two hospitals in one town, you know, they don't really have to give anybody any higher wages who works there. And it's even worse if it's a monopolist. And one of the reasons we've seen wage stagnation for the last 40 years is the fact that we've had the economy grow and grow in concentration. And, you know, we're in a situation where, you know, the corporations are unprecedentedly profitable, but they're not sharing the money. And one of the reasons they don't need to is because of the prevalence of oligopoly and monopoly across the economy. So this antitrust revival is about more than just, oh, I don't like big things. It's about the fundamental precept of equality and distribution of income across the nation.
I should also note that these things are somewhat connected, that as we're seeing the tech companies achieve greater and greater power, that in turn is spurring additional waves throughout the rest of the economy. So the, you know, it was rumors about Amazon's forays into the healthcare industry that then in part spurred CVS and Aetna to merge. The more that Google and Facebook are taking of digital ad revenue, the more consolidation that we're seeing among newspapers and the media industry. So I think oftentimes what you see is consolidation spurs from one sector to another sector. And a lot of that is now happening in response to the tech companies. But it's much bigger problem than just tech.
Rachel asked by email, could a lawmaker ever successfully introduce legislation that says companies must designate a set percentage of their profits to raising wages for their workers before they can grow the business? Professor Wu, I think it kind of gets into whether or not the law can even do anything about companies, even setting aside Amazon, any company that gets too big.
You know, Congress can do what it wants. And one way that Congress did this in the early 20th century was to protect unions and collective bargaining from what they used to do, which is hire people to shoot the workers who were going on strike or other efforts to prevent collective bargaining.
Right.
So that was the method. You know, maybe that needs to come back. I think it's a good time to think creatively about how we can make sure the rewards of the economy are a little more evenly distributed. I think, you know, this country is turning on on itself in so many different ways. And I think one of the reasons is pervasive inequality. And the time is ripe for new ideas like the caller's ideas as to how do we fix that.
Lena, do you think the laws are up to dealing with the Amazons of the world?
I think in many ways they are. I think a lot of it comes down to what is your enforcement philosophy. You know, the antitrust laws were written over 100 years ago. They're written in broad and general and sweeping language. And so oftentimes what gives them teeth, what gives them effect is the enforcement philosophy that you're bringing to the table. And I think for the last few decades, we've had an enforcement philosophy that's generally assumed that markets will self-correct, that oftentimes forms of consolidation and integration will deliver efficiencies that will benefit consumers, and law enforcers have taken a dimmer view of some of the harms and consequences and inefficiencies that can derive from these forms of consolidation.
Sarah left us this message. Sarah writes, as an indie bookseller, what is disturbing is that Amazon is allowed to use books as a loss leader to sell other products with discounts we could not absorb and stay in business. This kind of practice is illegal in Europe and in other countries. Jillian emailed, I haven't shopped with Amazon for at least 7 years since I learned about the way they treat their warehouse employees. In the years since, I have made an effort to shop locally and have become more and more supportive of the shop local movement. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Let's add another voice to the conversation and mix up the debate a little bit. Joining us in studio is Carl Szabo, a professor at the Antonin Scalia School of Law at George Mason University. He's also the vice president and general counsel of NetChoice, which is a tech industry trade association. Carl, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening on the debate from the top. Let me bring you into the debate now. It seems like the core question really is how big is too big and how do we know?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's really important to first level set about, since we're talking about Amazon, let's level set on Amazon. Amazon's large, but it's far from the largest retailer. In fact, Amazon's only the third largest retailer out there, just slightly larger than Costco and Home Depot. Walmart actually remains the largest, three times the size of Amazon, and most people don't realize that. And when it comes to food, we saw a lot of activity in the news about the Whole Foods-Amazon merger, but Whole Foods only accounted for 1.2% of all supermarket and food and grocery sales, and Amazon less than 0.2%. Combined, they're still only the ninth largest grocer in the country. Number one, again, is Walmart, about 10 times the size of those two combined. So we have a tendency to have this laser focus on technology and the internet because it's right in front of us, but it's really just a small part of a bigger ecosystem. Now, getting back to your first question, which is, when is too big too big? Well, first you have to have a monopoly. I mean, that's essentially what we're talking about here. Prefix of monopoly is mono, meaning one. When you're talking about Amazon and they're only the third largest retailer, they're clearly not a quote-unquote monopoly. And then once you are a monopoly, then you have to abuse that monopolistic power in some way. And Lena mentioned this, you know, predatory pricing, raising prices, preventing competition. So you have to abuse that power. And one of the things that we've seen, actually, with respect to Amazon is, and Lena did this in her paper quite well, she shows how while Amazon's valuation is going up, prices for consumers remained flat. And that's really great. That shows that Amazon doesn't have market power because prices remain flat. If they controlled the market, they could increase prices and you couldn't go anywhere else. But it's also really good as a consumer. I like low prices. I mean, think back 5, 6, 7 years ago. The idea of two-day shipping was beyond the pale. Nobody paid for that. That was crazy. But now it's standard. And not only that, it's free. And now through competition with Walmart, Target, and a lot of other sellers, free shipping is standard for all consumer purchases, and two-day shipping is becoming standard.
Amazon's kind of one of those weird animals in the business world, though, Carl, isn't it? I mean, it's one of those companies that for years just lost money. It made great revenues. It made awful or no profits for a long time. And Jeff Bezos, the founder and CEO of Amazon, was really clear. He was like, if you don't like our profit and loss statements, sell our stock. We do not care what you think. It's almost like he went the other way around in terms of building what some would argue is a monopoly. Does that change the calculus at all?
Not really, because what Jeff Bezos did was, rather than holding money back and just kind of sitting on it, like you see a lot of companies have giant piles of cash in reserve, Amazon took their revenue and a surplus and reinjected it into the company, building out the business and growing it to the point where they are now turning a profit. Most businesses are loss leaders for many, many, many years, and only after several years of innovation, optimization, and growth do they finally achieve profitability.
I want to let Lena and Professor Wu jump back in just a second, but in terms of the size of Amazon, you mentioned that Amazon is not the largest retailer out there. It's still Walmart. There are larger players. Is it possible that maybe they're all too big? That maybe Walmart is too big, and Amazon is too big, and these other retailers are too big, and they all need to be dealt with?
Actually, in today's day and age, never before have you had so much choice. Historically, you'd walk down the street and there'd be maybe one or two stores, maybe one or two supermarkets, and you basically had to take what they were selling. You had to take the offerings and the prices available. But today, just yesterday, I was looking for a new pair of shoes. I looked on Amazon, then I looked on Rakuten and buy.com. Turns out Rakuten had the lowest prices. I went there. I didn't go to Amazon. I went to another seller. And this is what's amazing about the way in which we operate today. Their competition is just a click away.
Lena, let me let you respond to that.
Sure. Well, there's a lot there. I mean,
there,
I think
there is. And we'll give you ample time to respond to as much of it as we can. But let's at least get it started.
Yeah, I mean, I think as a first-order matter, oftentimes the degree of choice that there appears to be is often an illusion, because oftentimes there's so much consolidation, and yet we still see many brands. So, for example, if you go to the airport and you see 8 different kinds of kiosks for rental cars, those are actually just owned by 3 companies. And so I think oftentimes there's an illusion of a choice across our economy. I think with Amazon specifically, I think it's misguided to really think about Amazon as a share of all retail globally, for example. I think the relevant question is, you know, if you're a merchant and you're looking to reach consumers, what pathways do you have to market? And for the majority of consumers, for majority of merchants, when they're looking to reach consumers, they have to ride Amazon's rails. Amazon has really emerged as the critical infrastructure for the 21st century economy.
We'll continue.
And so,
Lena, I hate to cut you short. We got to take a quick pause, but we'll continue with you. I'll let you finish your thought in just a moment as we continue with Lena Khan, Carl Szabo, and Professor Tim Wu, and we'll get to some of your questions as well. Michael wants to know, do you think Jeff Bezos' political ideology and Amazon's positioning as a socially progressive company impact the conversation around its size? Good question. We'll answer that in a moment. Stay close. We'll continue in a moment after a quick heads up about tomorrow's program. There are many places online to get news, but Reddit is one of the top sources for all kinds of information. All kinds, including some that is deeply offensive or thoroughly misleading. Now, most of Reddit is innocuous, and its executives favor a hands-off approach in terms of what content to crack down on. Where do you go online to find a safe space to express yourself, free of the trolls? Is Reddit meeting your needs, or do you go elsewhere? Leave us a voicemail, 855-236-1A1A. Now, for that matter, maybe you used to have spaces online to speak freely, but they ain't what they used to be. What changed? Tell us your story, 855-236-1A1A. Or you can use our app, 1A Vox Pop, to send us a radio-quality audio file and to keep up to date on future topics. We will share some of your stories tomorrow on 1A. Back now to our conversation with Professor Tim Wu, Lina Khan, and Carl Szabo. Still time to get in some of your questions and thoughts as well, 1A@WAMU.org. TW tweeted, on Patriot Act, which is a comedy series on Netflix, on Patriot Act, Hassan Minhaj pointed out that Amazon controls a huge amount of our data through their web store and web services. Experts are saying that those who own the data own the future. Amazon's power over us is enormous. Professor Wu, I wonder if you could react to that, particularly with regard to how government might think about regulating companies like Amazon.
Yeah, sure. So I think that this reinforces the falseness of the idea that competition is one click away at this point. You know, everybody in Silicon Valley knows that data confers an enormous advantage. One of the reasons it's so hard to compete with Amazon or compete with Google is that they have these, you know, enormous amount of information about you and therefore, they can improve their products in a way that's almost impossible for a new competitor to get a start on it. So I think that data has this real danger of destroying the basic big data, has done a lot of damage to the basic precepts of competition. Not to mention the fact that I think people are becoming increasingly concerned about just this. I mean, this is the problem I talk about in my book. It's more than just economic. It's political. Having so few entities with so much knowledge about you and in some ways so much influence over what you do with just the right prompts or pushing you in certain directions, it's not what we think about as a democratic system. Unaccountable power is the enemy of the American system, yet we've sort of tolerated it over the last 20 years because we call it tech.
Professor Szabo, what do you think?
You know, it's amazing. The more we move away from an objective standard with respect to antitrust, and what I mean by that is looking at a multitude of factors objectively. We look at the numbers, we look at the data, we do some math, and we figure out, is a business subject to antitrust? If we move away from that to a subjective standard where we say, you know what, I just don't like this company, then we start to inject real danger into politicization of antitrust competition. So here's an example. Let's presume the President of the United States decides he doesn't like a newspaper because it's too big, too powerful, and nationwide reach and wants to break it up, turns to the Department of Justice. Well, if we're operating under a subjective standard where they say, I just don't like it, that's a real danger to democracy and operation of businesses and just our moral values.
So, it's interesting. This president actually did get involved in the AT&T Time Warner merger, and many felt that that was just an expression of his animus towards CNN, which is owned by Time Warner, which is now owned by AT&T.
That's exactly it. We need to keep it objectively based. Once we allow emotions to drive the policy on antitrust, then it goes from a tool to a almost a weapon for politics.
But aren't there, but there are laws that are based on standards that are not purely quantitative. I mean, the law on the standard on obscenity from the Supreme Court ruling Miller versus California has a very subjective standard baked into it. It says, you know, that to the average person applying contemporary community standards, the dominant theme of the work taken as a whole appeals to the prurient interest in sex, the patently offensive as defined by law, and lacks serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value. That's Miller v. California from 1973. None of that is quantitative. All of that is subjective.
That's court-created doctrine as opposed to federally created law, which is what we're talking about here. And if anything, I want to make it harder for the government to take action against private citizens than easier. And the best way to do that and to make sure it's not abused and not subjective is to keep it in an objective, look at the data, look at the size, define the market, and then go forward.
What he really means is let's do nothing, which is what has been the policy of the antitrust.
Well, wait, hold on. That's not what I heard from him. I didn't hear him say let's do nothing. What I heard him say is let's do something that is quantifiable, that appeals to a different kind of objective standard of fairness. I didn't hear him say do nothing.
That's right, but that's because it's a complicated way of saying let's do nothing. I mean, the antitrust policy the last 30 years has said, well, let's try to be more objective, focus only on prices, and it leads, we have 40 years of experiment to look back at, and it leads to one kind of case, which is a price-fixing case, or the occasional merger to monopoly. That's the only case that, under the kind of standards that he's been advocating. And I want to suggest that my argument isn't that we make antitrust something subject to the whims of, you know, whatever the president or Congress thinks should happen. The point is, and our real point, is that the underlying goal of antitrust is to describe a certain kind of economic structure which we think is less dangerous, has less potential for abuse of power. That is an economic criteria. In fact, you could specify it very clearly. In the original merger guidelines, starting to get technical, in 1968, they had just sort of structural presumptions. This is too much concentrated power. That's an economic objective criteria. We shall not allow size to get. What has actually happened is it's actually gotten more subjective because now the antitrust laws are constantly a series of supposedly objective economic criteria, which end up becoming a battle, and something like the AT&T Time Warner merger ends up being a question as to whether they were going to raise prices by 43 cents or something. No, if we want an objective standard, we need clear structural ideas as to what is too big and not let the companies get past those.
I wonder if that's a good place to bring in a comment from one of our listeners. Tony, who's listening from Naples, Florida, left this in our inbox.
It's not just about the size of the company, but when a company with the scale of Google or Facebook, which has this massive platform and uses military-grade targeting technology to specifically deliver advertising or content to change people's opinions and their views on the world as it exists, and can be leveraged by a third party, which is often obfuscated, it can undermine an entire democracy. And when something like that happens, when it gets that big and it's being used in that way in a twisted manner, then the government definitely needs to step in to save the foundation of our society.
Tony, thanks very much for commenting. Lena Khan, I wonder if you would respond to that. It feels like part of what Tony's saying is that the issue is kind of what a big company does with its bigness.
I think that's right. And I think what he also points out is that the dangers that attend bigness are all the more stark and severe when you have companies that are critically involved in mediating news and information, that are critically involved in collecting hyper-sensitive and hyper-detailed information about us that will enable them to potentially discriminate. I mean, I think one fact that we haven't even talked about is that we're in a world where each company, especially digital companies, would be able to target us with specific prices. So we could all be seeing a different price for the same good or service based on what this company happens to think we'd be willing or able to pay. That's a dramatically different kind of power than even, you know, the A&P or Walmart enjoyed as the monopolists of the last century. And so I think...
I'm sorry, Lena, but back up on that a second, because if I buy gas in different parts of Washington, D.C., it will cost different amounts per gallon based on the demographics of people who live there. How is what you're describing any different from that?
What I'm describing is known as first-degree price discrimination, which means that every individual person will be charged a different price based on what this company knows about your willingness to pay, about how often you visit the website, what time of day, how often you keep items in your shopping cart without clicking on them. I mean, the degree of information that they have to target you with personalized discrimination, personalized prices is really of a totally different order and magnitude.
So it wouldn't be regional. It wouldn't be like everybody who goes to this station pays this amount. The price, to carry the metaphor forward, could follow me from gas station to gas station because I earn a certain amount and I'm from a certain place.
Exactly. You and your neighbor could pay totally different prices for the same good.
John tweeted, I love the ease of shopping on Amazon and the great prices, but the more I look around, there are so many large store spaces for lease. It's changing the landscape. I'm not sure that should be okay. Carl, you talked about not having a subjective standard for this, but there are people who live in communities in this country that have really struggled because of the Amazons and the Walmarts of the world. I mean, we know what Walmart has done to small retailers. We know what Amazon has done to bookstores, and now Amazon is selling books. I mean, something about this just feels wrong to a lot of people, especially in smaller communities, especially small business owners who feel like, well, I guess I'm just screwed. I worked hard, studied hard, rose early, slept late, put in 16, 17 hours a day to build something I dreamed of, and along comes Jeff Bezos and just gobbles it all up. Thanks a lot. What do you say to that?
You know, one of the things that I like to think about the internet and online marketplaces in particular, not just Amazon, but eBay, Etsy, many others, is they're really the last best hope for Main Street, because Main Street, people just don't walk down it anymore. Historically, if you were a store owner of, let's say, boutique goods, you kept your doors open and hope like heck that a customer just happens to walk in front of your store and see something they like and walk in. But today, with online platforms, you can now find customers across the country. Etsy is a great example of how boutique artists are able to find people interested in that specific item very easily. So it's actually been really helpful. Two quick stories on that. One is a company called Papa Shot. They make a basketball game, an arcade game. They were really struggling with sales. They went on Amazon Marketplace and their sales went up 1,000% because people were able to see it. And you were talking about books. Example that's really close to my heart is the book The Martian by Mr. Weir. Well, he couldn't get a publisher to publish his book. Nobody thought it was any good. He put it up on Amazon. Sales took off, and now we've got not only more people reading a great book, but we got a great movie out of it.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Julia tweeted, personally, I find Amazon convenient with two small kids, but if that's a main way to get things, it makes net neutrality even more essential. If you don't want Amazon, you need to research it and buy elsewhere from an independent shop. Sandra emailed, as a native Detroiter, I so wished Amazon established themselves there. Imagine the help that would have provided this beleaguered city. There is so much land available for development. Professor Wu, I do take Sandra's point. There's been a lot of argument in terms of the hoops that Amazon made cities jump through for this HQ 2+1 and the political power that it exercised. But if you live in a Detroit, if you live in a Gary, Indiana, if you live along the Florida panhandle that just got nailed by a hurricane and is thinking about how it's going to rebuild itself, 5,000, 10,000 jobs from Amazon just feels irresistible.
It does. I can understand why these governments would want to go in those directions, but I think it shows the power of too much concentrated private power. You know, who is pulling the strings here? It's supposed to be a democracy where governments are responsible to people, as opposed to governments sort of bending over backwards to try to please one or two firms. And
but what if
the
people say we want Amazon? What if Detroiters had said, please bring Amazon to town?
Well, you know, I think people have a right to do that, but I think that the concentration itself is the prior problem. I mean, healthy economies, as Detroit should know, are not built on one company or three companies. You know, if you want a long-term, healthy, sustainable economy, you need an ecosystem of firms, industries that are actually in competition. That has traditionally been the American way. That was once the American economy. When we've bet hard on centralized economies, we end up with disasters. We end up with what's happened, frankly, to the industrial Midwest, which was focused on U.S. Steel, the Big Three, these giant industrial giants. And when they start to die or decide they don't care about these towns anymore, that's it. We've been there before. I'm afraid we're heading down the same direction, making the same errors we made in the 20th century. And I think we should return to the original American vision of small business running this country, instead of us turning ourselves inside out to try to appease a few people who put their money wherever they feel like it.
I know we have to let you go shortly, but I wonder where, Lina Khan, where you think that this whole debate is going. Clearly, people are paying more attention to things like these big online retailers, the size of social media companies. Where do you see this going in the next few years?
I want to start just by responding to something that Carl mentioned around, the way that Amazon and these tech companies are enabling all these merchants to bring their goods to market. In reality, the situation that these merchants face is that oftentimes, they're the ones undertaking the original risk of bringing a product to market. But as soon as they bring that product to market, Amazon's able to see that it's doing well and then will oftentimes roll out a direct replica and make the original business disappear from the platform. So that's actually the reality that these merchants are facing on many of these platforms of total unaccountable power and of seeing their risk be appropriated ultimately by an Amazon. As far as where this conversation is going, I think there's been an enormous change in the last few years in terms of the public conversation and the public recognition that throughout our economy, we've seen dramatic consolidation and we've seen the growth of these giants in sector after sector, and that is causing a lot of consequences from higher prices to lower wages to dramatic declines in entrepreneurship and new business formation, as well as deeper harms to our democracy and to people's everyday liberties. And I think acknowledging that there is a problem, that something has gone awry and we need to do something about it, is the first step. I think where the debate is right now and where it's going to continue to be is, so what do we do about it?
Do want to acknowledge one story from a retailer, Joanna, who posted on our Facebook page, consumers may be getting lower flat prices right now, but the suppliers are getting squeezed. My father owned a small specialized publisher for 40 years. Amazon at one point was over a year and a half behind on payments. Small businesses can't sustain that. We finally went to pay on demand, and Amazon consistently priced our books under our own retail site. Absolutely predatory behavior. Lina Khan, a senior fellow at the Open Markets Institute and the author of Amazon's Antitrust Paradox. Thank you, Lina, for being with us.
Good to be here.
Professor Carl Szabo of George Mason University's Antonin Scalia School of Law and VP and General Counsel at NetChoice. Professor, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And Columbia Law Professor Tim Wu, author of The Curse of Bigness, Antitrust in the New Gilded Age. Thank you, Professor Wu.
Thanks.
This show was produced by Morgan Givens. To learn more about him and the rest of our staff, visit the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Joshua Johnson. This is 1A.